Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper on Sunday, November 4th.
That's correct.
2018.
Correct again.
Okay, it's a beautiful day. It was a beautiful day.
Yeah, we've been waiting for fall to happen. We've been waiting for the leaves to change colors, and it happened today.
To the extent there was a peak, it was probably today.
All of a sudden, you woke up in the morning and went, whoa, who turned the switch on here? So we'll see how long-lived this is, but it was a remarkable change.
Yes, it was absolutely lovely. We had a busy day driving around.
Yes, we've been all over.
We both had chores to do. My chore was going to Princeton, to the Princeton Art Museum, taking some students from my various classes to see the museum in preparation for writing their museum research papers.
Yes, and it sounded like a success in the way you described it.
It was a success. Princeton's a nice little museum, free, small, amazing collection for the size that it is. Mm-hmm. And we also go into the Princeton Chapel.
Oh, really?
Which is like a mini cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just on a sunny day like today, the stained glass is an explosion of
yes.
color.
Exploding
and
glass.
I've probably said this before, but it was built in the 20s. It is dedicated in 1925 to replace an exquisite little chapel that burned down.
Oh, really?
That had stained glass windows by Tiffany Lafarge.
You're kidding me. And it burned down?
It burned down.
It was on the campus?
It was on the campus.
Oh, that's awful.
And so they replaced it
yes.
with this mini Gothic cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was some pushback about the idea that it was Gothic. Like, ooh, isn't that a little bit popish?
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you probably remember, Princeton starts out as a Presbyterian school.
Mm-hmm.
But collegiate Gothic is all the rage
really?
At this time. Princeton wants to run with the big dogs, Cambridge, Oxford.
It does look like that. It looks
yes.
like one of those PBS shows.
And so the powers that be are persuaded to go for this style.
Yeah.
It also coincides with the time that they end mandatory chapel.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I did manage to avoid going into the chapel during 4 years at school there. So
but part
I saw
of the
it from the outside.
Part of the idea was,
yes,
we will create a chapel so beautiful,
yeah.
the boys, and there were only boys there at this time, the boys will go to chapel on their own.
Well, I would say
they
failed.
They won't need it to be
Speaking
mandatory.
Speaking from experience, they failed miserably in my connection. So
anyway,
wasn't enough for me.
It was beautiful.
Really? Good.
Yeah, everybody enjoyed
it. Well, I know your students get a lot out of it. That's the main thing to me, and particularly the Princeton Museum, which for some of them is, I understand, a real experience, even though they don't live that far from there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so and
anyway. Worth the trip.
All right, great. So we went to a play on Thursday. That's what we should report on first. We saw a play called Bernhard Hamlet with Janet McTeer playing Sandra Bernhardt, the great actress of the late 19th century.
How about Sarah Bernhardt?
Sarah Bernhardt. What did I call her?
Sandra.
Oh, my mistake. Sarah, her big sister Sarah, the greatest actress of the late 19th century. And the star is also Dylan Baker, who's excellent in it and been on a lot of television shows. But
Well, Dan just likes it because he was in The Americans.
He was in The Americans.
And Dan's
favorite anyone who's
TV
in The Americans is good
okay
with me.
Okay with Dan.
Exactly. They could have used more Americans. Look, I had some trepidation about seeing this show. It's one of those, you know, New York Times politically correct specials. It's sort of blared with the idea of you're not going to like it as much as the reviewer. And the reviewer loved it because they thought it, I don't know, said all the right things about all the right political points. I
when
was
wary.
You say
political, you mean?
I mean, it's celebrating women or whatever.
That's political? It's political
days,
to celebrate women?
Not in
I
some
thought
kind.
It was just mandatory.
That's the same thing. But look, it just sometimes the Times gives a review when you say they like the play because they feel it fits in with their political philosophy, which is pretty obvious from the rest of the newspaper. It happens quite a lot, actually. And as a matter of fact, they gave it a great review at the same time that the Wall Street Journal gave it a very negative review. And I think Vulture.com, which is New York magazine, also gave it a very negative review. So really, all indications were it was going to be a long night at the theater. But I like to think of myself as open-minded. And the truth is, I liked it.
All right.
I liked it.
Well, the story is that Sarah Bernhardt has planned to play Hamlet.
Right.
As Hamlet.
Right.
Which is a male role.
Mm-hmm.
She was a superstar.
Absolutely.
As an actress.
Right.
Who seems like could do no wrong.
Could do no wrong. Could do anything.
And this is about whether it would be wrong.
And it didn't quite work out, but in some ways it did, in some ways it didn't. We don't have to go on about it except to say that Janet McTeer is great in this. I think it was hard to imagine this show without Janet McTeer.
Yes.
She is fantastically energetic, fantastically modern, notwithstanding that she's playing an actress in the 19th century, terribly engaging, fantastic.
Right.
And she's riveting, and that's what makes it work. I mean, it's not a one-liner. It's not we can say there was this one moment that it was building towards, and it's not a great play. It's by Teresa Rabach, who's somewhat accomplished. But we enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Would you say you enjoyed it?
It was okay.
Okay. My
but I have some tidbits for you.
Oh, really?
So the play itself revolves around kind of invents or exaggerates a love story between Sarah Bernhardt and this playwright.
Playwright, right.
Edmond Rostand.
Mm-hmm.
And she is trying to convince him. She convinces him, actually, that he should rewrite the Shakespeare.
Right, right, right.
To make it a little less poetic.
Mm-hmm.
So
it fits her better.
So it fits her.
Yeah.
So that's part of the conflict results. In the end,
he writes another play.
Cyrano de Bergerac.
Exactly.
And, which is a huge hit.
And what is it recognized as a classic play.
Yeah.
And all this is true, right? These are real names, real people.
Meanwhile, she engages somebody else.
To rewrite it.
Two other people.
To rewrite Hamlet.
To rewrite Shakespeare.
Right, exactly.
She's got good enough for Bernhardt. And she does put it on, and it is a success.
Yeah, sure.
So there is that. But here's the interesting thing.
Sure.
Right after that, Rostand writes her another play.
And? How's that
and go? It is called L'Aiglon.
And?
And it is the story of Napoleon's son.
And she plays a man?
The Duke of Reichstadt.
Does she play a man?
She plays the Duke.
Oh, really? And how did that go?
And it was a big success.
Oh, really? That's great. Well,
in 1900.
All right, you're getting this gratis here, and none of this was in the play. So
I should also, I don't know anything about Edmond Rostand. He also wrote a play called Les Romanesques,
mm-hmm.
which is the inspiration for The Fantastics.
Interesting. Okay.
Longest running play in the universe.
Yes, that's right. Small theater. But yes. So you had something about a guy who's got a much smaller play going on Broadway, perhaps not Shakespearean.
Yeah, I'm not going to really talk about his play. It's Mike Birbiglia, playwright, mm-hmm. and he writes an article in the Arts and Leisure section of this week's New York Times called How to Get Your Show to Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got a new... Is it a one-man show? It's a very small show.
Yeah, I think it is a one-man show.
I'm not positive about that called The New One that is just getting to Broadway. And anyway, he just says, he allegedly gives some tips for what you have to go through to get your play to Broadway. And actually, just some of the things he says just kind of resonated with me. Not because I'm a playwright. I'm not a playwright.
Mm-hmm.
But just life lessons,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. And in one of his little paragraphs, he mentions that he needed some inspiration, and he goes to his wife for some kind of inspiration about the early years, achievements or milestones of their baby daughter. And she goes to her notes and pulls out kind of a poetry, and this is what it is.
Yeah.
An infant reaches for something, I don't know what, pushes it farther away, and cries in frustration each time she reaches, not realizing that she is crawling for the first time. She is just like her father.
Good.
I like that because times we're struggling like crazy to do something and we're frustrated because it's not happening, and yet something bigger is happening.
Yes, I agree.
In the process.
That's great.
So there is that.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a discussion about rewrites and the idea that one of his college professor pulls out a screenplay for American Beauty,
mm-hmm.
and it says at the it's noted on the top, draft 12.
Right.
The point being,
you do a
that
million drafts.
Nothing springs full grown
yeah.
out of Zeus's head.
Well,
you
listen,
know,
yeah, no,
things go through a process,
mm-hmm.
and you need to edit, and you need to craft, and you need to cut back and add on and rethink.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all part of the process.
Well, I was telling you, I just caught something on the satellite radio, an interview with a woman named Stacey Mindich, who is the sole producer of Dear Evan Hansen. And she was a new producer. And she basically coached the show from the very beginning, from you know, the young creative team, and she added a director as it went on, et cetera. The process that took years, that it was rewritten and redrafted and rewritten and redrafted and recast and forever. And it started with Arena Stage and was a success there. And then it still didn't move it to Broadway. Then it went to off-Broadway. Then they took a while to move it to Broadway. It's amazing that they took as long and changed it as much as they did. But that's what it took. That's what it took to make a success for Dear Evan Hansen. So that's a process.
Yeah. And, you know, you should prepare yourself for that.
I will.
Not even limiting it to playwright.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Writing,
no,
you know?
Absolutely.
And then finally, under the heading, brace yourself for criticism. Revealing yourself, he says, can be lonesome. When an audience doesn't respond, it feels like they're saying, not only do we not like your show, we don't like you as a person. And sometimes they are saying that.
Yeah.
So don't hang out with those people.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's sort of reminds us of what people have been saying about the Mets, which is, you know, we don't like the Mets and we don't like you as a person. So where are we with the Mets? The Mets, what do you think the
We're
odds
nowhere.
Are? What do you think
We're
the
nowhere.
Odds are for the Mets winning the World Series next year? Pick a number. 10 to 1, 20 to 1, 30, 50 to 1.
You know,
I'm
not a math fan.
I'm going to give you a chance to make a bet. They're 30 to 1. We can make a bet right now. I'll give
that
you 30 to 1. You put
that
up $100.
Seems eminently logical to me.
You put up $100 right now. If the Mets win the World Series, I'll give you back $3,000.
And what do you think the odds are that no matter what,
yeah.
the beginning of the season next year, you will say, I think they're going to do well.
Yeah.
I think they've really
well,
got
hard.
It this
it's hard
year.
Not to reach that conclusion. They're a talented
Every
bunch of youngsters.
Every year you say that.
They have
this
new...
year you were especially, especially.
But next year they have a new general manager. A new general manager. And Brody Von Wanigan. And we're trying to figure out that this makes sense. And it makes so little sense, it might work. He's a player agent. So instead of getting someone in the job of general manager who was a general manager, or a manager, or a general, or anything having to do with that job, they don't do that. They get a player agent, a guy who's been negotiating against them and representing players and not representing management. And I think out-of-the-box thinking puts a shine on it. It seems
well,
ridiculous.
Now he can't negotiate against them.
He can't negotiate
They've
against
them. They've taken him out of the
yeah,
loop.
There are other agents willing to pick up the slack. The question is...
But he'll know how to... He'll be in on their...
Here's my theory as to why this could help the Mets. For no other reason than this, because the ownership, which is the real problem, the Wilpons, are so in love with this guy, Brody Von Wanigan, who's an appealing guy. He looks the part. He went to Stanford. He seems smart. He's successful. He's the son-in-law of Neil Armstrong, the astronaut. He's got everything going for him. And they're enthralled with this guy. So he may be actually be able to cause them to act like decent owners. They
like
are going
step
to follow
back and let him.
Yeah, they'll follow his lead, and they've
okay.
never done that. And if he does that and nothing else, he stands a better chance of being successful than any other candidate. So, I of course am cautiously optimistic about the Mets, and I would take
once again.
I would take the 30 to 1. You and I can work that bet out later, but I think they're on to big things. Just give them time. Pitchers and catchers in February. Start reporting.
Looking forward to it.
Yes,
the edge of my seat.
Yep.
Meanwhile. I don't want to talk much about museums, and I already am.
Yeah.
Because it was museum overload.
It's all right. People
in the last podcast.
I can take it.
But I do need to mention that they're having some shenanigans in the Arms and Armor.
Shenanigans. There are shenanigans.
Department.
Yeah.
That is to say...
In the Metropolitan Museum.
The Metropolitan Museum has engaged young break dancers to come in and don armor and dance about. Mm-hmm. And they say they are really getting a sense of the ancient arts of armor, etc., and jousting and whatever else those guys did in that equipment. And they've done at least one already. The next performance is November 9th. They're going to be doing it in January, February, March, April, June. So it might be fun. Arms and Armor is one of the great departments. It's a fun place to go. Kids always love it. It's just fascinating.
Well, the kids in your class love it.
The kids, yeah. The grown-up kids
right.
love it. We all love it. There's an interesting, the curator was, sniffing around for, ideas and came upon a 1924 Met-produced silent film about a suit of armor that posits the question, does your knight ever come to life in the ghostly moonlight? And it does, stepping forth from the display case to ride a horse around Central Park.
Okay.
So that, to me, sounds pretty amazing and fascinating. And, you know, Arms and Armor was one of the key sort of seeds, key beginning areas of collecting in the Met.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, and it remains quite a fascinating...
All right. Well, talking about formidable... I don't know. Figures. How's that? That's good. Formidable figures. Willie McCovey passed away. Willie McCovey played for the San Francisco Giants. He was one of the great, one of the elite, great sluggers in recent baseball history. He played for the Giants. He came up as a rookie in 1959. He played for 22 seasons. He's one of the few players who played for four decades. I can give you the others later in case you're interested, Tamsin. The key is you start in 1959. And you go on. But the point is, he immediately had an impact. The Giants had a guy named Orlando Cepeda, who had been the rookie of the year the previous year, playing first. He comes onto the scene, also plays first, and pushes Cepeda out, and he becomes rookie of the year. They end up both in the Hall of Fame, by the way. The
Giants
And the Giants' big star, of course, Willie Mays. And he was overshadowed by Willie Mays, you would have thought, except for one thing. Willie Mays was thought of as a star of the Giants that began in New York, but they moved to San Francisco in 57. So San Francisco said, we want our guy. That's Willie McCovey. And their favorite was always Willie McCovey and not Willie Mays. And Willie McCovey was a great slugger. Mays batted third, McCovey batted fourth. And he was just the most feared hitter in the league. He had screaming line drives. He was 6'5". He was very athletic, really ripped the ball, fearsome hitter. And his big moment came in 1962 when the Giants were playing the World Series. And the series was tied 3-3. It was game seven. It was the ninth inning. The score was 1-0. They were losing. But there were two outs in that ninth inning with a man on second and third. Mays on second, Matty Lou on third. And Willie McCovey up. And a base hit would win the game. And anything but would lose the game. And the series hung in the balance. And Willie McCovey hit a screaming line drive. But it was chest high to the second baseman, Bobby Richardson. He snared it for the Yankees. The Yankees won the game 1-0 in the series 4-3. And that is one of the great moments in series history. McCovey went on to have this fantastic career. At one point, with 521 career home runs, he had more home runs than any other left-handed hitter in National League Baseball history. The Giants continue to honor him as their favorite player, in San Francisco at least. The right field section beyond the fence now is called McCovey Cove. You may have heard that. The ball lands in the water. It lands in McCovey Cove. He won all sorts of awards and, of course, the Hall of Fame and so on. And he was interviewed just a few years ago, and he was asked this question. How would you like to be remembered? And here's how McCovey responded. I'd like to be remembered as the guy who hit the line drive over Bobby Richardson's head.
So would have been nice.
Would have been nice. But it, one of the great all-time baseball players.
All right. So now you know, Willie McCovey. Back to the world of movies and theater.
Yes.
There's an article, well, there's a big section in the New York Times about holiday movies. Mm-hmm. And we'll discuss that more in depth. But one of the articles going along with the summaries of everything that's coming up is an article about screen musicals we need to thank for Hamilton. And it's kind of an interview with Lin-Manuel Miranda telling the influence of movie musicals on him.
Right.
And his favorites.
Well,
and here's what he says.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you this first. One of the hardest things to do is to make a successful musical, he said. I don't mean financially successful. I mean artistically, where all the art forms, the choreography, the music, the dancing, the sets, the songs, all build towards these moments. When they're all working in tandem, I do not think there is a more thrilling art form.
I agree with that. But we should read his choices, because I think they're curious choices for his favorite movie musicals. And I'll tell you why.
A lot of them have to do with his context growing up.
I'm not criticizing the man. He's beyond criticism. He wrote Hamilton. I got that. But go ahead.
The first one mentioned is Little Mermaid.
Little Mermaid's great.
Okay. Then we have Singing in the Rain and The Bandwagon.
Okay. So Singing in the Rain is a great movie musical, and it's one of those that was written as a movie as opposed to a play, as is true of Bandwagon. And it is great. The Bandwagon's not. But we've watched it. It's flawed. It has some fun things in it. And it's interesting that Lin-Manuel Miranda cites the final scene in which Oscar Levant and others sing in tribute to Fred Astaire, as you know, that's entertainment. And that to him is a great scene, and I will tell you, that is an awful scene. It lays like a lox in the movie, and I don't know what he's thinking. But anyway, that's his opinion. We all have our opinions.
So Chicago?
Chicago's a very good movie musical based on a musical play that was better than the movie. So okay. You got to take that. That's right.
And how about Labyrinth?
I see that. That's where I'm not. I don't get that because I don't know anything about
it. David Bowie.
Don't know it. But I will say the best on his list is The Little Mermaid.
That was a game changer.
I think that was a great musical. You can't say no.
But that came out around Thanksgiving.
It came out Thanksgiving. I remember I took the kids. 1989.
Of the kids. One of them was too young.
One was too, but two of them to it. And we all left, not just the kids, we all left wide-eyed. Oh my God!
Yeah, that's true.
I will tell you. Are you going to give? I'll give you my favorite movie musicals.
What are your favorite?
Well, I think it's my favorites for better or worse. I think jive with what anyone, what most people would say the favorites are. The two best, I think, are pretty clearly West Side Story and Oliver.
Yeah, Oliver would be right up there for me.
Yeah,
West Side Story, and you know, again, I have a personal growing up context where South Pacific was
my
favorite.
I didn't go back to that.
I actually went out and earned money so I could see South Pacific a second time.
Okay,
and it's not like I saw it when it came out.
I think that's fair, and it's fair to give a Rodgers and Hammerstein show in there. I was thinking also the Music Man. But the
Music Man is super duper.
But the Music Man is a staged thing. I mean, they just filmed the stage play.
Yeah.
So it's kind of cheating. South Pacific is on the set, not on the set, on real conditions. So.
And I will say, I get a kick out of Gigi.
You're changing my mind. Gigi is a great musical. Obviously, My Fair Lady also. But
yeah.
Again, My Fair Lady is such a great play. You hate to acknowledge it as a movie, but Gigi was written for the movies, and Gigi is great. It's hard to get a 7-year-old to sit through it, but it's because it's long, but it's great. I agree. But we were talking about Oliver just the other day, and
my whole family went out to see Oliver on Christmas Day.
Talk about a game changer.
When we were little.
Oliver. Yeah. Look, I think Gigi was best picture. I think Oliver was best picture. I know West Side Story was best picture. Yeah. I know Fiddler on the Roof was best picture. Yeah. Beyond that, I'm not sure. But those are great movie musicals, not The Bandwagon. All right. So let's see. What else did we want to cover? I think you wanted to talk about the holiday movies. Go ahead.
Holiday movies. So, these sections are always impossible because they give these teeny little summaries.
Yeah.
And it never matches up with what the good movies turn out to be.
Yeah. Because
you just can't. It's never about the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. Things that caught, the number one that caught my eye, and this is not going to be a good movie, but it's called Swimming with Men.
Mm, yes, I do know that.
It's all of my dreams.
Yeah. Let's keep your dreams to yourself just for the moment.
Okay. Starring Rob Brydon, who apparently was Steve Coogan's sparring partner in the Trip movie.
Yeah, we saw those movies.
Yeah, I know. I'm saying it for our audience.
Well, he's also in the Laurel and Hardy movie coming up.
Oh, really? He is?
Yeah, sadly. Oh. He plays Stan Laurel.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward
anyway,
to that.
Anyway, and this is about a man suffering midlife crisis joins a synchronized swim team in a feel-good film based on a real-life event.
Yeah.
And it has these, I saw a photo. It has, like, normal, you know, comfortably...
Guys, don't look good in Speedos.
Yes.
I got it. Yeah.
Guys swimming...
Dad bodies
synchronized swimmers. Yeah. So, and maybe that will be funny. The other thing that caught my eye is All Is True.
What is that?
Ooh, that is a Kenneth Branagh movie.
Yeah.
And it stars him as Shakespeare and Judi Dench as his wife. And it has something to do with the Globe Theater burning down and Shakespeare goes back home to his wife or something.
Really?
So intriguing. I mean, anytime you have Judi Dench.
Yeah, I don't think of you as a Kenneth Branagh fan, honestly. But
we'll see. We'll see.
Okay.
And you had your eye on a few things.
Yeah, I mean, I am a Kenneth Branagh fan. Maybe even more than Judi Dench. But you've got this list all over the place. Okay, so...
Well, you had this one.
Oh, yeah. I think Mary Queen of Scots might be interesting. Why? Because of the 19th movie called Mary Queen of Scots? No.
Who's in it?
Because it's Saoirse Ronan and...
Saoirse
Ronan and Margot Robbie? No. Why? Because Bo Willimon wrote the screenplay. The House of Cards guy. So that could be interesting.
Yeah, you know what? He also wrote The Parisian Woman,
which was a dud. But it's a different take on things. Give the guy a chance. Give the guy a chance.
I gave him a chance.
All right. Wait, there's more.
How many chances does he get?
If I can... here's the movie everyone's talking about. It's Roma, which is the movie about this Mexican housekeeper. And all I can tell you is it's getting rave reviews in the film festivals, so you got to look out for it there. There's Mary Poppins Returns. This is because Lin-Manuel Miranda is in it, and... you never know. It's also Rob Marshall, who did Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, Emily Blunt is nice.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility.
I've never been a fan of the Mary Poppins movies.
All right, well, I can understand
because
that.
Because they're nothing like the book. Books are superb.
Yeah, I would say when I was growing up, the Mary Poppins movie was super. And,
disappointment. I can't tell you how
there's
disappointed
no, look, I think
was.
People understand.
I think any P.L. Travers fan would agree with me.
I think anyone who's listening to us understands how much more sophisticated you were.
I can sing every song.
Much more.
From the movie.
How much more sophisticated you were than me.
Not a good movie.
At any event, and then there's Welcome to Morrowind, which will either be a total dud or it might be interesting, in which is a story about an emotionally isolated individual, a fellow played by Steve Carell, who suffers brain damage in an assault, and then begins making a model of a fictional World War II-era town and casts himself as a war hero with digital wizardry. It's something they couldn't explain that must be going on in that movie. So we'll see.
Can I just mention it's Steve Coogan that's in...
Steve Coogan. Oh, yes, you're right.
In the movie.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Stan
Laurel. You're absolutely right. That's what I meant to say.
Movie. That's what you meant.
That's exactly what I meant. But you know something, and this is going to be a theme later... usually at this time you see three or four movies that really are vying for Best Picture, and you say, well, that's a powerful movie. That might well win. That's it. I'm not seeing anything like that, but we'll see. I'll give it time. Open-minded. That's me.
Good. We'll be surprised.
Yeah. All right, and finally, there is an article apropos of nothing in the Wall Street Journal about one of the great songs and great song performances that you could possibly witness, and that's called One for My Baby and One for the Road, which is a song written by Johnny Mercer and Harold Arlen, as recorded by Frank Sinatra in 1958. Why they're writing about this, I don't know, but I don't mind, because they go on for at some length to talk about Johnny Mercer, first of all, who you know was a fantastic songwriter. They say that what motivated him to write the song in large part was because he had a love affair that was broken off. Interestingly, that love affair was with Judy Garland.
I had no idea.
Yeah, I had no idea. The young Judy Garland. That broke off, and that caused him to write this song. As they describe it here, it's a story of a dramatic monologue. That's a masterpiece of urban loneliness and loss. The singer tells the bartender about a, quote, little story that he thinks he should know, but he never really tells him the story. But his emptiness and despair rouse our compassion. Who can't identify with an unhappy end to a relationship? Well, and it is recorded by Frank Sinatra several times, but most memorably in his on his Only the Lonely album in 1958. And the entire album was really, in many people's view, a reaction to or reflective of his broken-off love affair with Ava Gardner. So you have that in both the singer and the songwriter. But what they say about it here, and we'll play it for you at the end, which will make the point much better than I think anyone in the journal could make it, even though they try well. They say, in Sinatra's 1958, One for My Baby, five elements come together, lyrics, music, singer, accompanist, and orchestra, to produce a classic of American music. Sinatra's slower tempo makes a huge difference, allowing the singer to milk the story for all its melancholy emotion. He brilliantly uses the element of time in another way, personalizing the written rhythms to insert pauses and hesitations, all in the service of drama and emotion. You can't help but share his pain. Well, that's quite the buildup. But we will leave you at the end with...
On a little bit of a down note.
One for My Baby.
Sad to say.
It's not a down note. It's just a great song. But until next week...
This is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan, read the paper. See you next week.
Thanks.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my babe, and one more for the road. I got the routine, put another nickel in the machine. Feeling so bad, can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you've gotta be true to your code. Just make it one for my baby, and one more for the road. You'd never know it, but buddy, I'm a kind of poet, and I got a lot of things I'd like to say. And when I'm gloomy, won't you listen to me till it's talked away? Well, that's how it goes. And Joe, I know you're getting anxious to close. And thanks for the cheer. I hope you didn't mind my bending your ear. But this torch that I found, it's gotta be drowned, or it soon might explode. So make it one for my baby, and one more for the road. The long, it's so long.